Welcome to Legal Lens, a DebtWire podcast on legal issues impacting restructuring and the distressed industry at large. My name is Andy Serby. Today, I'm joined once again by Joel Cohen of Stout. Joel's a managing director in the Disputes, Compliance, and Investigations group there, as well as the New York office's managing partner. Joel has over two decades of experience in the dispute, forensic, and insolvency practice areas, most specifically focused in the financial services and asset management industries. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks, Andy. It's great to be back.
So as the rest of the world takes a really close look at the United States following the election, we are taking a big look at the rest of the world. We're going to be talking international restructuring today. Since you've already been here, I don't know how much a self-intro you want to do, but you can go ahead and give us a little bit of that. And then let's jump right into one of the big issues internationally, which is asset tracing across jurisdictions.
Thank you. It's always good to speak with you and take a pause to reflect on what's past and at this point in time, what we might expect from the new administration and the world as they look at the United States in this moment of time. Certainly, plenty has happened since the last time we spoke. There's been ups and downs and industries impacted and lots to discuss, and especially on the international front.
Absolutely. So I think one of the initial topics that we need to get into is what are the kind of hot overseas markets. I think we all know a few of the names, but I know that you have specifically spent some time in the Caymans. You're there right now, right?
Yeah, coming to you instead of live from New York, it's live from Grand Cayman with lots going on here. There's always people gathering, talking about asset management, asset tracing. You know, depending on the statistics you look at, 30 to 50% of the world's private investment funds or hedge funds are domiciled out of Cayman. So it's an important place to be and an important place for insolvency when something goes wrong.
Great. And can you tell us a little bit about why you think that is? And then let's go through a couple of the other really popular international ones. Like, we see a lot of activity out of Hong Kong, Canada, Brazil, and Brazil has also just become kind of the Chapter 15 for the bankruptcy perspective, the Chapter 15 hub for South American insolvency.
So first, the industries maybe or some of the international areas of impact, as you've asked, I think in this past year and what we expect are several sectors that are due for a little bit of volatility or might have an increased volume of insolvency filings or bankruptcies. We've seen in the U.S. The electric vehicle industry is absolutely impacted. You know, the typical flood on the market, interest, an increase in demand for electric vehicles and all that service it, and then a rush to try and fill that need. And now you'll see the fallout from supporting companies and supply chain and electric vehicle companies that are experiencing distress and then eventually filing for bankruptcy. The cannabis industry had a similar playbook where there was a rush with the advance and deregulation of cannabis. And now, you know, we're having to deal with some of those insolvencies. And while they don't always fall into the federal bankruptcy code, the receivership line has taken shape. And I think there are also ways that practitioners are finding to utilize the bankruptcy code to deal with them. Digital assets, I'm sure we'll talk about. And real estate, you know, will the bottom finally fall out on real estate? We've seen some international impacts in larger companies there. And will that eventually shift to the U.S. in a bigger way than what we've seen? But here I am in Grand Cayman. And why is Grand Cayman so important? And why is it these financial centers, be it Hong Kong, Grand Cayman, Luxembourg, others, BVI, why are these places so important when we talk about these industries? And often we have to take a step back or a step up from where investment comes from. You know, where are the actual holding companies and where is the large investment in these industries? And it comes from this private investment fund industry where it's sector focused. It's taking a look at where monies should be put to use. And these financial centers are the bed for pulling together and pooling together investors from across the globe into a structure that can either invest in the U.S. economy and in industries that I've just spoken about, or invest in international companies and being able to do so not only with tax neutral circumstances, but just a capability of having a central ground for investors from international backgrounds.
Right. And to your point about kind of centralizing investment opportunities, that's probably why we see a significant amount of activity with the SPAC companies in that part of the world.
Exactly.
So shifting back to kind of the broad view of a broad restructuring, from your perspective, kind of as an advisor, what traditionally causes an engagement from your point of view to broaden to an international approach? Like, what is it about a case that comes across your desk that says, like, okay, we have to take a broader view with this one?
So I think, generally speaking, over the past two decades, companies have become more international. An industry need in the U.S. can easily be expanded internationally, and our world is just more connected than it ever has been. So companies' general financial footprint, it's rare that it's just domestic. I think that the opportunity in international markets is too great, and companies have taken advantage of that, and investors have demanded that. But traditional asset tracing and litigation and insolvency will expand into international markets when these companies fall into distress. And so if there is suspicion of fraud, or if there is malfeasance by the principals and the insiders of companies, they're not just going to keep it domestic. It's going to be moving assets across the globe in a way that might help protect them or help hide them from those that are interested in trying to recover assets. And so we have lots of different examples of what might draw us into the international market. So if there's a tax fraud investigation for a U.S. company, you know, that's led by the DOJ, and it's a structure that includes an offshore component, rest assured that the assets that are disappearing, or the revenues or the income that's being hidden from the U.S. government or from the IRS, that's an important component to this investigation, that you'll need to get into these international markets. Asset forfeiture, where companies and subsidiaries are holding assets and holding value, oftentimes cannot just be limited to the United States. There's good reason to be looking outside of the U.S. and utilizing either these international financial centers or just the financial footprint that exists across the globe.
Right, absolutely. And again, staying in the broad category before we really start drilling down here, from your perspective, what are some of the new challenges that get introduced when you start having to think internationally with a case?
Well, like the trend of companies generally longing to be international, or there's just a greater international presence for larger companies, the court system has matured in many of these jurisdictions. And so there could be greater coordination between the courts. But with that coordination, you have to understand the conflicting regulation or the geographic issues or language barriers and things that might mean one thing in a U.S. court means something different in somewhere else. So these are great challenges. You know, the rights of a creditor in the bankruptcy code are defined pretty well. Those might be different. Recognition of redemption creditors in the Cayman Islands is different than in other jurisdictions. Costs. The challenge of running an international, multi-jurisdictional insolvency can be quite costly. And there are times where interested parties might want to avoid a costly Chapter 11 in the U.S. But in order to do so, you're now coordinating with various teams of professionals in different jurisdictions. You know, really understanding the familiarity and the jurisdiction in which you're dealing is important, and having the right people there to help you understand and have a handle on that is really important. I guess one of the last challenges is the maturity of the market in which you're dealing. You know, federal law is something in the U.S. is something that's alive, that is developed over time, and there's a history there. And if some of these international jurisdictions don't have that maturity or don't have the case law that's been tested over time, you could put yourself and the issues that you're trying to deal with at risk.
Right. And to the prepared company, to the prepared, well-advised company, there's an argument that some of these also present opportunities, right? With taking advantage of differing codes, like we just had Intrum AB, you know, case out of company more largely based out of Sweden. And it was alleged in their U.S. case, the argument was rejected that, you know, they founded a company here and they pursued their Chapter 11 in Texas because they didn't have the creditor support for their prepackaged plan to get shot through at a high speed in a Swedish court, but they had enough for Southern Texas. Or there are, you know, companies that might try and seek a form of minor relief or approval or a stamp of approval from a court abroad that they might have a harder time getting here in the inverse, and then they'll seek recognition here. It's not all costs and all challenges. It can also be a matter of perspective.
I totally agree. And, you know, there are benefits, whether it's an international insolvency administration or proceeding or U.S. bankruptcy court, oftentimes when a company or a fund is in distress, it's time to stop the bleeding. It's time to put a marker in the sand that a restructuring is necessary. And so whether that is first done in Europe with the signal of an administration or ends in Texas with the filing of a Chapter 15, the necessity of a stay or of notice to creditors that there is distress and a restructuring is necessary, I think, is the point.
We're going to get into digital assets next, which kind of alluded to earlier. So given any potential uncertainty in U.S. markets for multiple reasons, you know, we see an increased interest in crypto and potentially a friendlier regulatory environment to it, the looming specter of tariffs. What are some of the issues that you think can lead to kind of asset tracing issues or abroad issues by itself?
This arc of digital assets has been really interesting, certainly for you and I, Andy. As people in the distress world or in the insolvency space, you have regulators in the U.S. that have been reluctant to establish legislation or a regulatory framework for digital assets. And so what ends up happening, you have major insolvencies where the bankruptcy court judges are making policy and informing risk management protocols and governance. And we've watched this happen now for a few years. And now this administration is coming in as quote unquote crypto friendly and interested in providing this community the regulation that it needs or the support that it needs to continue to develop and mature. And in one sense, that's great. You know, it's great that there have been some lessons learned and that this community can mature. And we're watching the value or the price of Bitcoin and other digital assets flow and fire high in the sky. But as you know, what goes up must come down. And we've seen volatility in this market, you know, unprecedented volatility. If the volatility markers for stocks and bonds and what have you can be 10 to 20%, we're looking at 80% volatility in certain periods of time for digital assets. And so the insolvency practitioners are waiting to see how this administration continues to support the community of cryptocurrencies and digital assets and all the supporting businesses that go with it, but also preparing for a downturn for what could happen if prices come down.
Right. And I remember watching these crypto cases and thinking to myself, this is probably the most that the general public has cared about bankruptcy cases since, I don't know, Enron or maybe PG&E, but that was mostly localized to California.
I agree, especially you have large creditor bodies all, you know, with their hands on Twitter or X or on YouTube and dissecting the bankruptcy protocols and trying to understand bankruptcy law to see how and when they might be able to return value to themselves and to the people that they're working with. The world was focused on it. And in that time, we were able to develop a valuation methodology that was accepted by the court, you know, providing for an asset that's unlike other typical assets that have procedures in certain markets. We've watched the capital market structure of digital assets mature, but it's still young, and we still have to see how we might deal with these larger companies. But, you know, the trend will continue to be up. The administration is keen on supporting this community. And so now the community is reacting by having an increased interest and driving the price and value of these coins up.
Absolutely. And again, this is an effort that, you know, we see crypto has been pushed around as one of the really easy ways to move money around the world, which again circles back to the importance of taking an international view when you have an engagement that involves digital assets such as these, because the FTX asset recovery effort was a multi-jurisdictional effort, a multi-jurisdictional criminal effort too, in some respects. And that holds true for really all of them.
That's right. I think one of the purposes of these digital assets is to be able to move value across jurisdictions seamlessly and with ease. And so that's taken place. We watch these cross-border insolvencies take place in many jurisdictions and seeing how the different court proceedings were coordinated or the benefits And so there are lessons that have been learned in many of these. I think we'll see greater coordination. I think we're going to have the courts look back at these cases and be informed and realize how important it is to act swiftly and to coordinate with one another, knowing that it's not just closing down a platform coin or a particular currency, but it's the alternative assets, it's the mining companies, it's the structured lending that crosses borders that will coordinate and impact each of the proceedings, and that there needs to be some sort of coordination. And also, just getting us back to the asset tracing component to this conversation, as the digital asset world has matured, so have the tracing tools and the ability to find wallets that haven't been detected, or to be able to trace in a way so that you're utilizing the blockchain in the best possible way and you're able to recover assets. We saw pretty remarkable recoveries and discoveries of wallets that provided value to those that were harmed by some of these insolvencies. And so it's good to have those tools and be ready should one of these larger companies experience distress.
Absolutely. We've talked a good amount about the current lay of the land. Let's do what we always do towards the latter part of these episodes, and we're going to take a little bit of a look forward. Given the potential increased prominence of international courts and jurisdictions, would you expect U.S. companies to give an increasing look at doing things abroad and then maybe coming here? And are there any particular areas that you expect to see an increased interest from companies who are looking to restructure other than the U.S.?
Yes, I think we are going to see companies explore other jurisdictions when they need to restructure. We've seen more interaction with different bankruptcy or insolvency courts. And so there's more coming out of Hong Kong. Hong Kong has gotten some attention because of the larger filings, whether it's Evergrande out of China or others. They're putting themselves on the map for insolvency restructuring and being a jurisdiction that companies and professionals are comfortable in. So we're going to see more interaction. I think there has been an increase in Chapter 15 filings and relief. And while practitioners enjoy the discovery processes in the U.S. and can find out more information and help inform a restructuring, you know, it's a question of what other jurisdictions might be utilized. We're seeing more activity out of Brazil, as you had mentioned in the early moments of our discussion, and I think we'll see more of that. Brazil has its challenges, but it certainly has developed a better interaction with international courts and in the U.S. I think that knowing all of this and the increased knowledge of the rights of creditors and the ability for interested parties to access different jurisdictions to protect their rights, I think actually creates leverage to maybe push for out-of-court restructurings, to have parties come together well-informed of what could take place internationally and try and coordinate something out of court so that damage isn't done to the value of the entity in play here. So I think increased coordination amongst the jurisdiction for sure, and it's just a question of having that happen early on in the early days of distress or of recognition that a restructuring is necessary.
Right. And that's not even to mention coordination with, if we take a very, very narrow view of the term abroad, we can even narrow that down to potentially increased coordination among U.S. jurisdictions as they kind of move apart on potential legal splits before the Supreme Court gets there. You know, there's an ever-increasing difference between filing in New York or Delaware or New Jersey versus filing in the Southern District of Texas or somewhere in the Ninth Circuit, for example. It's all just, in a way, kind of an example of the ever-growing toolbox and the wider world that's available not just to companies, but also to creditors.
That's right. I think the toolbox is continually being refined. The case law is alive and is helping to inform the decisions that are being made now. And we're seeing that across the U.S. and different judges and different jurisdictions having a greater understanding of these complex companies. You know, the creative solutions that are being generated by the professionals and by the companies themselves, knowing their creditor body.
Absolutely. And I think that's about as good a bookending statement as we could come up with out of whole cloth for this whole talk. Joel, thanks again for coming on to share your expertise with us. I appreciate your time and all the thought you put into it.
Thank you, Andy. It's always great to take a moment of pause and think about all that's going on, because it can be quite hectic at times.
The world is very wide. The corners of the map are filled in.
No doubt. Thank you.
And thank you, as always, to our listeners. We'll have this episode up on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, plus available on debtwire.com. We'll see you next time.